This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and this is a special one-hour best-of series, and we're going to kick things off with a piece called Forgiving My Worthless Father, and this is by author Leslie Leland Fields, and she lives in Alaska. She's a writer. She's our Northern Lights contributor. Well, her dad, it turns out, was not a very present dad. He moved away as soon as he could. He was a semi-abusive guy. He lived alone, didn't hold a job. But what was Leslie to do about this man and the force he held on her heart and her life? Let's take a listen.
Often, we think the cost of forgiving is too high, but we don't consider the cost of not forgiving. I found relief in releasing his debts against me, especially as I realized my father could not pay what he owed me. I found the yoke of forgiveness lighter than the yoke of hurt and hate. And I found the yoke of caring for him easier than the burden of abandoning him. And love came back. Yes, in small doses. One day he called me amazing. He phoned on my birthday. And when I came to visit, one time he didn't want me to leave. And all this was new. All of this broke my newfound heart. Forgiving my father has changed me. The broken and bitter parts of me are healing. And that one forgiveness has led to others, into my own apologies to those I know I have hurt. I'm moving toward the person I hope to be. And my father was touched as well. In the last 2 years of his life, my worthless father was surrounded and blessed by the very ones he had harmed. I think he felt loved, perhaps for the first time.
I'm moving to be the person I hope to be. I think that's something we can all hope for. Now we're moving to a segment we did on Johnny Cash on the day of his birth, and how so often the media strips men of faith of that faith. Let's take a listen.
And happiness I've known proves that it's right, because you're mine, I walk the line.
Now in the beginning of Walk the Line, we see a young Johnny Cash go into Sun Recording Studios. He plays a gospel song, and Sam Phillips says,
I'm sorry, I can't market gospel no more.
Sing me something you care about. And he does. And by the way, that scene really happened in real life. But for the rest of the movie, we don't hear really anything about Johnny Cash's faith, his struggles with God, and all of the gospel music he recorded. Indeed, there were some scenes that could have been in Walk the Line that weren't, that were in the book, A Man Called Cash by Stephen Turner. And one of them happened in 1969. He was invited to Woodstock by his pal Kris Kristofferson, but he declined. He instead appeared on his national TV show on ABC and ended the show with this song, which I believe was a rebuttal to what was happening at Woodstock.
Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Were you there when they crucified my Lord?
In the end, Cash always a countercultural figure. In this instance, a countercultural figure to the counterculture. Always a rebel. What also wasn't in Walk the Line was Cash's recording of the New Testament, Cash and his relationship with Billy Graham. Leaving Johnny Cash's faith out of this story would be like leaving naked young women out of Hugh Hefner's. It would be like leaving race and segregation out of Jackie Robinson's story. Time and again in Stephen Turner's book, A Man Called Cash, we bump up against Johnny's struggles with his faith, and in the end, his return to faith. The book ends with a story about Johnny turning the Ewan McCall song, First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, and turning that song from a love song to a devotional song to a gospel song.
The first time Whenever I saw your face, I thought the sun rose. In your eyes.
Just one more song that was not included in the soundtrack of the movie Walk the Line.
And the moon and the stars.
Which debuted 10 years ago today on this day in history.
Were the gifts you gave. To the dark. And the endless sky, my love.
And from the sacred to the sublime, one of our favorite segments is, well, Hengler and his rants. And on this particular day, he was excoriating us for not using, well, wet wipes and using instead toilet paper. And this is the infamous wet wipe toilet paper rant from Hengler.
So here's my situation. You have a baby, and it's got, a poopy diaper. And your wife says, "We're out of wipes, honey. Could you bring me some wipes?" And you brought over a roll of toilet paper. What kind of look would she give you? She would think you were ridiculous. Why? Because it doesn't work! It doesn't work! A kid is outside playing in the mud. They come in the house. Do you throw them a dry towel? No, because it doesn't get it off your hands. If you get a tiny piece of something sticky on your hands, some Tabasco sauce, you don't take a dry piece of paper and get it off. Even if it disappears, the look, the smell is still there! The Tabasco smell is still there. If you eat barbecue wings, you don't wipe it off with a dry Kleenex. You get a wet nap. Come on, people, wake up! Stop being sheep and following everybody who uses dry toilet paper! Wet wipes! It requires wetness to get rid of everything! Wake up!
There you have it. This is Lee Habib. This is a special best of hour. This is Our American Stories. More after this. Johnny Carson, Schindler's List. More after this. Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and for the hour, a best of hour. And right now, we want to dig into our hour on Johnny Carson and what made him great. You know, one of the unique qualities we'll learn about Carson as we go on, no matter who sat in that chair, presidents, ordinary Americans doing bird calls, he treated them all the same. None of them got preferred status or diminished status. He just played it even. And he just loved, he loved people. Arsenio Hall, host of the breakout late night Arsenio Hall show from the 1990s, illustrates, well, one of the other things that Carson had going for him, and it wasn't just humility, it was a near perfect sense of timing.
He had the perfect barometer in his head of when to go and when to stay out. He could save you if the show needed it, or he could let you do your thing. His ego could let you do your thing.
And this is what made Carson great in the end. Joan Rivers, well, she agreed with him.
He knew where you were going. He knew when to come in and say, "How fat was she?" He knew when not to say it. You knew you were bringing your little gift to him of a joke, and you knew he was going to open it and love it.
Here's Jerry Seinfeld's very first appearance on The Tonight Show.
My folks are moving to Florida. They don't want to move to Florida, but they're in their 60s, and that's the law.
Long Island. I think you evicted from Long Island, aren't you, at 60?
They have like a leisure police of some kind. Get the golf clubs and get in the van, folks.
Listen to Carson laughing. See, the thing is, he wanted his guys to do great when they appeared. Some stars don't want to see the people sitting next to him do better than them. This was the key to Carson. Leno couldn't replicate this. Letterman couldn't replicate this because their egos were too big. Colbert, Stewart, love them, but they never made their guests funnier. And this is why none of them held a candle to Carson. And they all looked up to Carson as a genius, but didn't quite understand the reason he was. We hear now from a grateful and emotionally moved Drew Carey describing his first appearance on The Tonight Show.
Curtain opens. You know, Johnny Carson introduces me, and it's just like I dreamed it. It's just exactly like I dreamed it. I go on a stage. I hit the mark.
Denny's has my favorite thing on the menu. It's a hot dog with cheese and bacon. Yeah, not enough nitrates in a hot dog. Gotta put some bacon on top of there. And for an extra dollar, they'll put chili on top of the whole thing. For people who don't care anymore.
I remember seeing Johnny Carson holding onto the desk. He's holding onto the desk because he's laughing so hard so he doesn't fall off the chair. Because he's like convulsing.
That's the kind of food just marches right down your throat, you know? Follow me, boys. We're going to the heart.
And he goes like this. And I go, who, me? And he goes, yeah, you. And I'm like, oh, no, nobody gets called over for the Tonight Show. That's a big thing. It's like a religious experience. And then after that, my career was made.
You're funny as hell.
Thanks, I appreciate that.
You really are.
Thanks. You too.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said you too back to Carson, and Carson left. Want to play a clip now, and Carson was so generous with this guy, and it's the one and only Rodney Dangerfield.
Smoking, that's another one. Try to stop smoking. That's a beauty, huh? Well, with cigarettes, my wife and I, we made a deal, my wife and I. We only smoke after sex. I got the same pack now since 1975. What bothers me is my wife. She's up to 3 packs a day. You kid, I know my wife cheats on me. Every time I come home, the parrot says, quick, out the window, you know?
What Carson would do is just set him up. He'd just ask a question and let Rodney take the stage. How many guys do that? They get in the way. And that was Johnny Carson. And now we go to a story we found in our own little Oxford Eagle on the front page here in Oxford, Mississippi, where this show comes from. And it was a story of a guy who'd struggled in his life, was looking to get his GED. He was a crossing guard at Ole Miss. And suddenly he got the idea to just start singing whatever came to his mind. And that's Willie Willingham's story. If we're walking by right now and you're on the street corner, what are you singing? Describe or actually perform for us just a little bit, if you don't mind, Willie. I know you're not shy.
Okay. No, I'm not shy at all now. But I would start off with something like, there's been times in my life when I had no friend. I had no one to call my own. But that's when he'll come your way, just to let you know that you always have some place to go.
Well, and by the way, Willie, as you're singing that, and some kid is walking to school and he's feeling lonely. And by the way, how often are we doing anything in our lives when we're not feeling what you just described when you were singing? The regulars that come by now, what is that like? I mean, you must have, I would assume, after having the courage to do this, and by the way, Willie, it took some courage to just start singing, whether you know it or not, to just start spontaneously sing in public.
Exactly.
It takes courage. Talk about some of your regulars, because I can only assume now that some people might even walk out of their way to walk by you.
Exactly.
Because I would.
Well, the thing was this, a lot of the ones that's my regulars now, was not my regulars. They was those that avoided me.
Right.
And those that would just get on the other side of the other people and, you know, kind of ease their way through the crowd till they got away from me. And now those are the ones that come out and, you know, they make it known, you know, I love it, don't stop. You know, and a lot of the guys, and it surprised me when a lot of the guys would walk up and they would give me high fives and stuff, man, don't stop singing.
And then on one of our best This Days in Histories, and my Cracker Jack team does an amazing job on these, the story of Oskar Schindler told through the voices of surviving American Jews.
On the eve of May 8th, 1945, Oskar Schindler had important news that the Jews in his care waited 5 years to hear. Here's one of Schindler's Jews, Leon Lason.
Schindler asked us all to gather around. He stood up on something high, and he told us that we were free. The war is over. The Germans have surrendered, and that he was going to leave, and these guards who were standing around behind him were going to leave as well, and he wished as well.
Also present at Schindler's announcement was Sol Urbach, who settled in New Jersey in 1951. Here he describes the reactions from his fellow Jews.
Everyone there was either in tears or in laughs, or trying to crawl toward Schindler to kiss him and thank him personally, which was impossible to do with 1,000 people. It was an emotionally charged gathering where we just were short of being able to express our feelings, the unbelievable achievements that we have survived the war, and it was Oskar Schindler that brought us to this point.
Following World War II, Oskar Schindler was isolated and rejected by his fellow citizens. He was called a Jew kisser, sworn at on the streets, and stones were thrown at him. Nobody would do business with him. There was even an attempt on his life. It was said that he was their bad conscience, the conscience of all those who had known something but did nothing. 2 decades after his release, Leon Lason reunited with his rescuer in Los Angeles. He wasn't sure Schindler would recognize him, but no reminder proved necessary.
I reached out my hand and started to introduce myself because I realized, you know, I was a grown man, and last time he saw me, I was not yet 15, you know. So he interrupted me. He says, "I know who you are. You're Little Lason."
Oskar Schindler took on perhaps one of the toughest forces of the 20th century, the Nazis, saving over 1,200 Jews during a time where over 6 million were being exterminated. If you picked up a handful of sand, it would have over 1,000 grains. Over 1,000 souls lived because of one Oskar Schindler. On October 9th, 1974, Oskar Schindler died. Upon his request, they buried him in Israel. 500 of his survivors were there. This day in history.
This is Lee Habib, the sublime, the sacred. We're celebrating some of our best segments here on Our American Stories, a best of for you and for us. More after this. Just let your love flow like a mountain stream, and let your love grow with the smallest of dreams, and let your love show, and you'll know what I mean. It's the season. Let your love fly like a bird. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. This is a best of hour, and one of our favorite things to talk about are random acts of kindness. This one we found, it was in a church bulletin, this story. We contacted the guy who posted it. His name is John Yast. This is his story.
This afternoon, after running a few errands, I stopped by the Horse Thief Hollow Brewing Company in Beverly on Chicago's South Side for a bowl of their really terrific chili. On being seated, I noticed a pair of Chicago cops having lunch nearby. I asked my server if the police still get meals for free, and he replied that they get a discount, but it's not free. So I told him to give the cops the usual discount, but I'd take care of the check. I assumed he'd be discreet and not finger the donor. But when the pair had finished their lunch, the female officer came over and thanked me. "You have no idea how much it means." I was about to remind her that it was only $20 when she continued, Everyone hates us. So if you see a cop or two having a cup of coffee or a meal, please show them that not everyone hates them. When I asked my server about revealing my identity, he said cops have a way of getting people to talk. I guess I should have seen that one coming. When I asked for my tab, the server told me, the man at the first table over there insisted on paying your bill. He wanted to buy lunch for the cops, but you beat him to it. I'm not sure if it's important to the story, but I think it might be. The man who bought my lunch is black.
A great story there by John Yest. And now on to, well, we have many conversations with Pat Williams on leadership, and this one was on the great coach Vince Lombardi. I wanted to play you a clip of Jerry Kramer. You know, we learned from Coach Wooden that he knew how to motivate his players, that he was a great psychologist, and he truly understood how to get inside the head of his players. And let's hear from all-time great guard and five-time Pro Bowl and All-Pro guard Jerry Kramer. And then let's get your reaction.
I jumped off sides one time in a scrimmage, and he got in my face, and he said, "Mister, the concentration period of a college student is 5 minutes, high school is 3 minutes, kindergarten is 30 seconds. You don't even have that, so where's that put you?" Put me checking my shoe shine. I go up in the locker room, sitting there, chin in my hand, elbow in my knee, looking at the floor, thinking, I'm never going to play for this guy. And he came in the door, came across the room, slapped me on the back of the neck, messed up my hair. He said, "Son, one of these days you're going to be the best guard in football." He turned around and walked away. And that started my motor. With that comment, he allowed me to think about being a great football player. And from that point on, I worked my tail off. I gave him everything I had. It made a profound impact on my life.
One day you're going to be a great football player. Talk about that, that both that discipline and being hard on the boy, but then quickly thereafter, and this is a grown man who is in many respects still a boy, as we all can be, then that planting of that seed, Pat, the planting of that seed.
Well, Lee, I think the message to all of us is that our words carry enormous impact. And it doesn't matter whether we're an NFL coach or a parent or a teacher, a school teacher or whatever. When we say something, we may not think much of it, perhaps, but the receiver of our words will never forget it. So here is Jerry Kramer with that little sentence. It was one sentence that Lombardi planted in him, and Jerry Kramer said, "That was the turning point in my career and a major turning point in my life." Amazing, isn't it?
Amazing it is. And now we turn to Mike Rowe, and you know him from Dirtiest Jobs and his new CNN show, but he has a podcast that we just love. And this was a story he told us about, well, the differences between a planned economy, communism and socialism, and a free economy. Here's Mike Rowe.
September 16th started off like any other day for the employees at Randall's Grocery Store. They arrived at 5 a.m. and began prepping the produce and wiping down the cash registers. The smell of baked goods filled the aisles as the employees began the endless process of stocking and rotating thousands of products on hundreds of shelves. It was really just an average day in an average grocery store. Until it wasn't. The boss showed up, anxious and frazzled. Apparently, some bigwig was in town visiting the nearby Space Center, and they had just received word he was about to drop by the grocery store for an unscheduled tour. Who could it be? Some muckety-muck from the home office? A shareholder? Maybe Mr. Randall himself, coming by for a surprise inspection. The boss barked orders to make sure the place was tip-top, and the employees took things up a notch. A few hours later, the store was sparkling, and the mystery guest arrived. Whoever he was, he didn't work for Randall's. Looking outside through the glass, the employees could see that This was clearly a very powerful, very important man. He had an entourage with security, and the media followed close behind. He was smiling for the cameras, confident and sure. But then he walked through those automatic doors, and everything changed. The man looked as if he'd seen a ghost. He wandered up and down the aisles, slowly at first, and then with increased agitation. His expression seemed to switch back and forth between fascinated and demoralized. He paused to stare in wonderment at the fresh fish, the meat selections, and the produce department. He was enraptured, peppering the customers with questions. At one point, the man asked the store manager what type of advanced education was required to run a store as magnificent as this. The manager blushed. The employees had never seen anything like it. By all accounts, though, it was the sight of frozen pudding pops that left the visitor in utter disbelief. Like an indigenous member of some forgotten tribe deep in the Amazon who glanced up one day and saw a 747 flying overhead, this well-dressed visitor, this highly educated, undeniably successful, and clearly important individual was left slack-jawed by pudding pops. There were just so many, in such a rich variety of flavors. By the time he boarded his private plane, he was unable to speak to his staff. His world had been turned upside down in an instant. You see, the man who visited the grocery store that fateful day in 1989 had just been elected to the new Soviet parliament. And in all his years, he had never seen so much food in one place. He later said, "When I saw those shelves crammed with hundreds, thousands of cans, cartons, and goods of every possible sort for the first time, I felt quite frankly sick with despair for the Soviet people. That such a potentially super-rich country as ours has been brought to a state of such poverty, it is terrible to think of it." And just like that, one man's loyalty to communism was completely destroyed. He returned home and promptly left the party and started making reforms. And then, just 2 years later, under his presidency, the Soviet Union would dissolve. True, Ronald Reagan told Gorbachev to tear down this wall, but back in 1989, that wall was still standing. And who knows, it might still be there today, if not for the hard-working employees at a Randall's grocery store in Clear Lake, Texas, who kept the shelves fully stocked. So another Soviet, a Soviet named Boris Yeltsin, could come face to face with a freezer full of pudding pops and change the history of the world. Anyway, that's the way I heard it.
And this is Lee Habib. Thanks, Mike Rowe, for that great story. More after this. This is Our American Stories. We'll close out the hour with Yogi Berra and Robert Plant. More after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, our best of hour. And this is a story by George Will, who loves baseball, and he wrote a column about a great New York Yankee who passed away earlier this year. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and each day we dig into, well, a special day in history. Last week, Yogi Berra died, and there's no better writer in America on baseball than the great columnist George Will. And so we asked George to record the column he wrote in less than 24 hours for the Washington Post. And here's that column.
It's deja vu all over again.
And the Yankees are champions. Now look at Berra. Piggyback riding Bob Cazala.
Thank you. 18-year-old U.S. Navy enlistee, thinking it sounded less boring than the dull training he was doing in 1944, volunteered for service on what he thought an officer had called rocket ships. Actually, they were small, slow, vulnerable boats used as launching pads for rockets to give close-in support for troops assaulting beaches. The service on those boats certainly was not boring. At dawn on June 6, 1944, that sailor was a few hundred yards off Omaha Beach. Lawrence Peter Barra, who died recently at 90, had a knack for being where the action was. When he stood as a catcher, he spent a lot of time crouching at baseball's most physically and mentally demanding position, 5'7". He confirmed the axiom that the beauty of baseball is that a player does not need to be 7 feet tall or 7 feet wide.
Barra swings, and that one's going to leave the ballpark. Well, what do you know? Larry Barra, they call him Yogi, his very first time at the plate in the major leagues against the A's. And what does he do? He hits a home run.
The shortstop during Yogi's first Yankee years was an even smaller Italian-American, 150-pound Phil Rizzuto, listed at a generous 5'6". Yogi had, as sports writer Alan Barra says in his book Yogi Barra, Eternal Yankee, the winningest career in the history of American sports.
Hall of Famer, catcher, Yogi Barra.
Played on Yankee teams that went to the World Series 14 times in 17 years. He won 10 World Series rings. No other player has more than 9. He won 3 MVP awards. Only Barry Bonds has more with 7, but 4 of them probably tainted by performance-enhancing drugs. In 7 consecutive seasons, 1950 through 1956, Yogi finished in the top 4 in MVP voting. He grew up in what he and others called the Dago Hill section of St. Louis, when the Italian-Americans who lived there did not take offense at the name. They had bigger problems. Biographer Alan Barra notes that in an 1895 advertisement seeking labor to build a New York reservoir, the ad said whites would be paid $1.30 to $1.50 a day, colored workers $1.25 to $1.40, and Italians $1.15 to $1.25.
And George, Will, what a piece of work that was. Now we go to the Wall Street Journal and Keith Blanchard, who wrote a remarkable story about father and son rediscovering the sea.
I'll never forget the raw anticipation I felt when our boat slipped free from the dock in the early morning when it was still dark, foam churning behind us to the thrum of the motor as we pushed North America away behind us. But kids grow up, and life moves on. My grandfather passed away, his boat was sold, and over time I kind of lost touch with both my old man and the sea. And so, decades later, right around the time I turned 40, I decided to stop thinking about it and to organize a father-son fishing trip. It took my dad about 3 seconds to say yes. And what would we fish for? Well, the ocean is filled with wonders. But deep water fishermen all share one bucket list catch, the marlin, king of the sea. And so my dad and I, with my good friend Roddy, an experienced marlin hunter, found ourselves motoring out past the chalky crags of Baja California's Pacific coast, 3,000 miles and a world away from New Jersey's Barnegat Bay, on the first day of a 3-day fishing trip. Out of the ghostly marina at dawn and into the cold, dewy air of the Pacific. With the ceremonial first beer a little later, we drank a toast to my grandfather, and Roddy gave us the brief. A cross between a shark, a unicorn, and a freight train, marlins often weigh more than 200 pounds, though some monsters are much heavier, and can swim as fast as a car, leaping majestically out of the water when trying to throw a hook. And they're Neptune's own serial killers, eating anything they can smack and stun with that bone-hard bill. They're also smart and worthy opponents that work hard to stay out of your boat, thrashing and slicing at your line with their bills, even fouling your lines by swimming under the hull. Hauling one can take an hour, sometimes much more, of focused work. Your job is to keep that rod bent, really in the line when the fish will let you. A few hours in, we lucked out. Fish on! My dad slid into the fighting chair, set the pole, and started winding away. At several points, I jokingly offered to take a shift, but he just growled and continued his determined struggle, ultimately reeling in a nice one, 160 pounds and almost 7 feet long from the tip of the bill to the fork in its tail. We took our proof of triumph photos and released the fish to help keep the population healthy. Later, we celebrated at a bar, where I became acquainted with the awkward feeling of drinking with one's father while busty waitresses wearing Pancho Villa-style shot glass bandoliers trot around pushing drinks.
And we close out the hour with a subject we love more than any other, and that is music. And with the story of the lead singer of Led Zeppelin, who, when we picked up the story, it had turned out, well, he was out of a job in 1981 and didn't know what to do. And he ends up finding himself in the hills of Nashville. And after a decade of pretty much being lost musically, drifting in and out of various styles, it turns out Plant needs to come back to America a second time, but this time not to the Delta, where he discovered blues, but to Nashville and to the folk, country, and gospel traditions that inhabited that region.
I found that there was more stuff underneath the covers going on, and it was still coming from Ireland and places in Tennessee and in the mountains where people just hadn't moved on. Families lived there for five generations without shifting from one township, so the music followed down through the families, and we got really old songs there.
In 2010, Plant, along with the Band of Joy — he'd won a Grammy with Alison Krauss just a year or two before — performed live for the BBC and closed out their show with this song, one you wouldn't expect from the lead singer of Led Zeppelin. And as it turns out, this is a song Plant had wanted to sing for a very, very long time.
I finally got my way after so many thousands of years of saying, why don't you finish the show with a song that says everything? And tried to sell the idea to a few people down the line, but we've got it now, so. Lay down, my dear sister, won't you lay and take your rest? Won't you lay your head upon my Savior's breast? But I love you, but Jesus loves you the best. And I bid you good night, good night, good night. Oh, I bid you good night, good night, good night.
One of these mornings bright and early and fine.
Good night, good night.
That was Plant in the first verse, singing along with some of the best Nashville voices. And a little bit later, the curtain pulls back and a gospel choir appears. And this is how the concert closed out.
Lay down, my dear sister, won't you lay and take your rest? Won't you lay your head upon my Savior's breast? 'Cause I love you, and Jesus loves you the best. And I bid you good night, good night.
I was walking in Jerusalem just like John.
Good night, good night.
I was walking in Jerusalem just like John.
Good night.
Was the bad boy of rock and roll singing the song he'd wanted to sing all his life on the stage, never having felt comfortable in his own skin and having a bunch of bandmates who thought it utterly ridiculous to sing a song so beautiful. And have you ever heard something so beautiful from Robert Plant? Sometimes you need to be in your 60s to figure out who you are. I bid you good night. Well, we looked it up. We tried to find the writer. There isn't one. Like so many great old gospel songs, it's just a traditional ballad. He had heard it in the hills of Scotland, and how many young people had heard it in the hills of Appalachia? No difference. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, the life of Robert Plant, his art, his music, and so utterly connected to the American story here on Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib. We'll be right back. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And now it's time for our This Day in History segment, brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, philosophy. And by the way, if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale can get to you with their terrific online courses. And in this feature, you're about to meet someone you've definitely heard of, but likely don't truly know.
He was born in the summer of his 27th year, coming home to a place he'd never been before. He left yesterday behind him. You might say he was born again. You might say he found the key for every door.
You've probably tasted their beer.
Coors. 105 years of only pure Rocky Mountain spring water. Make it yours. Make it Coors.
For some of you, it's more than a taste. It's a tradition. And for others of you, it's a daily tradition. After an honest day's work.
When a day's work was mining for gold under the frozen ground for 12 straight hours, happy hour had a whole new meaning.
Yet few have thought about the name and where it came from. How it was almost spelled Coors with a K.
A beer that's still known as the banquet beer.
A German name that got Americanized and changed to a C. A German name for a German man, Adolf Coors, who became an American man, an American legend. This is his story.
Rocky Mountain High, Colorado.
On February 4th, 1847, Adolf Coors was born into a family that was stable, until it wasn't. Tuberculosis took his mother from him when he was 14, and then came for father when he was 15. He was swiftly and suddenly an orphan. Perhaps providentially, there was a brewery right across the street from him, a brewery that would teach the young orphan a trade. That he could use, that we would use, for the rest of his life. Once again, things were getting stable, until they weren't. The King of Prussia decided he wanted to become Emperor of United Germany, and Prussian men were forced to make a choice. Fight the King's war, or leave the country. Adolf left the country, and he wasn't alone. An astounding 500,000 Germans emigrated to the United States between 1866 and 1870. With no money to his name, and almost no English in his vocabulary, the 21-year-old Adolf hopped onto a ship heading for Baltimore as an undocumented stowaway. Ashamed for not having paid his way, he took any job he could get in Baltimore to take care of the bill. Working as a laborer, in a brewery, as a fireman, a bricklayer, and a stone cutter. When he saved enough to venture westward, he did, landing at a brewery in a Chicago suburb. And when he saved even more, he ventured westward even more. His greatest luggage that he carried was his greatest vision, opening a brewery that he could call his own. Phil Anschutz's book, Out Where the West Begins, tells us why he decided to go westward, and specifically where. Kors heard talk of a booming new western city where Germans were the single largest foreign-born group, and he knew that where there were Germans, there would be brewing opportunities. Following his dream, in 1872, Kors climbed aboard the 3-year-old Transcontinental Railroad headed for Denver to settle there, if you could call it settling. He trekked across prairies, through wilderness, and into the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, all in search of superior water to brew a superior beer. Kors would find his golden supply in Golden, Colorado, where springs near Clear Creek River bubbled up with cold, crisp water from the snow-capped Rocky Mountains. And a golden location it was. The population of the Colorado Territory was growing, and fast. Anschutz writes, he learned that Clear Creek had been the motherlode of the Colorado Gold Rush, attracting some 100,000 fortune seekers in one of the greatest mass migrations in U.S. history. Kors did not seek the heavy yellow metal in Clear Creek. He figured its water could be transformed into liquid gold. To top it off, his golden town of Golden was 15 miles away from Denver, a young city, but one with 7 breweries. In Golden, he would be it. Only 3 months after acquiring his golden property, he was out in the town, carting around and selling his very first batch of beer. All 31 barrels of it. And customers quickly began to pour into town, just to get his beer. Anschutz notes how many arrived on the Colorado Central Railroad, which built a spur line across Clear Creek to the brewery. Today, the Burlington Southern Santa Fe still operates that beer line. A mere 10 years later, he won a national brewing competition at the big event, the biggest event of the era, the World's Fair in Chicago. Once again, things were getting stable, until they weren't.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and more on this remarkable American story, our This Day in History segment brought to you by Hillsdale College. More after this. American Stories, and we're back with our This Day in History segment brought to us by Hillsdale College. Today we are celebrating the life of Adolf Kors, the founder of Kors Brewing Company. When we left off, Adolf had found his golden water supply for brewing his beer in Golden, Colorado. But like so much of his story, things were getting stable, well, until they weren't.
His golden water was turning into golden disaster on what was supposed to be a golden day, Memorial Day. The year was 1894, and the flash flood came rushing down Clear Creek Canyon and into the town. Townspeople fled, dead sheep, flattened trees, and ruined buildings left behind. Left behind with the one man who wouldn't leave. Adolf Kors. He was determined to destroy the flood, or it would destroy him. The book Colorado Vanguards paints the scene. Adolph Kors stood ground between the raging waters of Clear Creek and his brewery. Determined not to leave, Kors watched as the water sheared off an expensive new addition to his business. The man-made ice ponds where his workers cut ice blocks in winter went under, and the waters kept rising, inch by inch, up the slope. What happened next was described in Golden's newspaper, the Colorado Transcript. When Mr. Kors found the raging torrent encroaching on his grounds, with his accustomed energy, he purchased several lots on the opposite side of the creek and put an army of men to work tearing down the houses on them and cutting away the ground in an endeavor to turn the channel away from his premises. This desperate plan, quickly acted on, worked. Even though his losses amounted to $10,000, the brewery survived, and so did Adolph Kors. Once again, things were getting stable, until they weren't. Enter the Prohibition Movement. In 1907, the nearby Boulder, Colorado, voted to go dry. In 1908, Loveland was next. Golden knew better, and in 1909, voted to stay wet. But in 1916, they were told their vote didn't matter. Colorado passed a statewide ban on alcohol. 4 years later, the nationwide ban took effect. The Kors Brewery was forced to dump 17,391 gallons of beer into Clear Creek. Kors family lore says that from then on, Adolph Kors never tasted beer again. With his beer not surviving, how would his company? The only way it could... start all over again and invent new companies, invent new products. Adolph and his sons founded a porcelain company which fashioned cooking utensils and scientific items. Adolph Jr. even invented a strong chemical porcelain that no one else supplied. Their porcelain was later used by the U.S. government for insulators at the uranium enrichment plant, which provided the fuel for the Hiroshima atom bomb. The company still exists to this day, now called Kors Tech, and employs 5,900 people. A malted milk also came to be, and so would a non-alcoholic beer called Manna. Although we haven't found any explanation as to why they called the near beer Manna, it may very well have biblical origins. From the story of God providing the Israelites food called Manna, so they could survive their travels in the barren desert. Americans were now in the barren desert of Prohibition, and needed something to survive it. Adolph would provide it with manna, although it reportedly disgusted him thoroughly to produce an inferior product. A more difficult decision was how to make do with more limited resources. The Kors family cut all of their own salaries, but Adolph was also forced to ask employees to take pay cuts. The employee union was having none of it, refusing to discuss it, and so they went on strike. Looking back on all that they had gone through, Adolph Jr. told his father, "Nobody should ever tell this family how to run its own business." Adolph Sr. agreed and fired the striking employees. If he didn't make such tough, difficult decisions, Kors might not have survived Prohibition. Most brewers didn't. There were 1,568 breweries at the start of Prohibition, and only 750 reopened when it was repealed on December 5, 1933. Adolph wouldn't see this day, but his company would. And it was because of his stoic approach towards life, an approach described by grandson William Kistler Kors in Anschutz's book. "My grandfather never thought backward, only forward. He didn't talk about the past, which had its tragedies. He focused on making the best beer in America." actor Paul Newman believed Coors did. And so he must have.
My boy says he can eat 50 eggs, he can eat 50 eggs.
Newman called it the best American beer bar none. He was so strident about Coors that he required it on ice at all of his movie sets and refused to be seen drinking anything but Coors beer. All the way up until 1981, you couldn't get Coors east of the Mississippi, making it for many a mystical treasure that had to be traveled for.
Wait a minute. Why do you want that beer so bad?
Because he's thirsty, dummy.
See, I got a boy running tomorrow in the Southern Classic, and when he wins, I want to celebrate in style.
How much style?
Well, I got a few friends and me, 400 cases.
And smuggled for. The very basis of the movie Smokey and the Bandit.
The problem is that Coors beer, you take that east of Texas, and that's bootlegging.
You know, I believe you're just a little bit scared.
That's great psychology. Why don't you just say something bad about my mother?
Your mama...
President Eisenhower joined in on this treasure hunt, requesting that his supply of Coors be brought to the White House on board an Air Force plane. And President Ford packed Coors in his luggage on return trips to Washington from his ski vacations in Colorado. Today it is the second largest beer company in America, the fifth largest in the world, and remains the largest single-site brewery in the world, producing more than 17 million barrels each and every year. And it all started with the man whose name adorns the beer, Adolph Coors. This day in history.
Great job on that, guys. That's just some great storytelling about a great American life. And by the way, we're going to be covering a few more of those lives in Phil Anschutz's book, Out Where the West Begins, Harrison Gray Otis's story, and Cyrus McCormick. And you'll love both of them. They're terrific. I wanted to close with just a short dramatic reading about this man's character right out of Mr. Anschutz's book. Coors ran his family as well as his brewery with tectonic firmness. Promptly at 6:25 every evening, Adolph and Louisa arrived in the living room. Hands washed and hair combed, the six children marched in for inspection. They always had to be on time, recalled longtime housekeeper Alma Brushwiller. Mr. Coors Sr. was always looking at his pocket watch. At 6:30, he took Louisa's arm and led the way to the dinner table. The six children followed in a straight line. Alma Brushwiller recalls, just like ducklings. After dinner, the old man would go out on the porch and exercise with a pair of dumbbells. Alma Brushwiller remembers Adolph Coors Sr. as a, quote, very German, very precise man about everything. He spoke with a German accent. He was very prim, neat, every hair in place. Even for his breakfast in the dining room nook, he would be all dressed up in a coat and tie. You could set your watch by that man. His life was the brewery. Even on Sundays, he would go walk through the plant, just checking on things. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories on this day in history. A great man's life celebrated. Adolph Coors.
seven women on my mind. Four that want to own me, two that want to stone me, one says she's a friend of mine. Take it easy, take it easy. Don't let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and you're listening to Glenn Frey singing the song that propelled the Eagles into stardom, a Jackson Browne song written by Jackson, their dear friend, who taught them everything they needed to know about songwriting. We'll get to that in a bit. Jackson Browne wrote most of that song. The reason we played it as long as we did is Glenn Frey made a key contribution, not only singing it, but when Jackson got stumped partway through, he turned to his pal, Glenn, who finished the second verse, starting with, such a fine sight to see, it's a girl, my lord, in a flatbed Ford, slowing down to take a look at me. And it unleashed the song for Jackson, so he put a co-write on that for Glenn Frey, his friend. Because it wouldn't have been a song without it, and it's true, he was stuck, and I see why. When you read the lyrics, you'll get it. And so for the next two segments, we're going to talk about Glenn and his life's work. Hear from him, hear his music. Born in Detroit. Kicked around, played with Seeger's band. Moved to L.A. And joined a pack of musicians and songwriters that dominated music in the 1970s. And he and Don Henley became as good a writing duo as there's ever been in the United States. Right up there with Rodgers and Hammerstein. And, well, Bernie Taupin and Elton John from England. Why a musician, though? Why a band? Because Glenn Frey had a solo career, but in the end, always returning to the band.
Just love singing with other people and finding harmony parts and blending and coming in at the same time, and scooping and cutting off right. And, you know, it really is a lot of fun.
It really is a lot of fun. And by the way, that's why so many guys join bands. I know it's why my sister did. You don't fit in high school as an athlete. You can't find your clique in academics. You're feeling a little lonely, a little awkward. You want to connect. You get an axe. You play the piano. You join the theater. You join the student newspaper. That's generally the impulse. And I know a lot of musicians, and they'll be nodding when I say that. So he moves to L.A., meets Jackson Browne, who's really a writer. And these guys are trying to become writers. They don't want to just be musicians because the singer-songwriter is what's most respected in the business, and those are the guys who make all the money, and they get all the girls. And so they're living in Echo Park in a little tiny apartment, and right next door is their buddy Jackson Browne. And this clip, you're going to hear why Glenn Frey and the band owe so much to Jackson, because they learned how hard Jackson worked and that it was a craft, this thing called songwriting.
You know, that was it. There was like a stereo, a piano, a bed, a guitar, you know, a teapot.
We slept late in those days. Except around 9 o'clock in the morning, I'd hear Jackson Browne's teapot going off with this whistle in the distance. And then I'd hear him playing piano. I didn't really know how to write songs. I knew I wanted to write songs, but I didn't know exactly. You just wait around for inspiration, you know, what was the deal? Well, I learned through the Jackson ceiling and my floor exactly how to write songs, because Jackson would get up and he'd play the first verse and first chorus, and he'd play it 20 times until he had it just the way he wanted. And then there'd be silence. And then I'd hear the teapot go off again. And it'd be quiet for 10 or 20 minutes. Then I'd hear him start to play again, and there was a second verse. So then he'd work on the second verse and he'd play it 20 times. And then he'd go back to the top of the song, and he'd play the first verse, the first chorus, and the second verse another 20 times until he was really comfortable with it and, you know, change a word here or there. And I'm up there going, so that's how you do it. Elbow grease, you know, time, thought, persistence.
Elbow grease, time, thought, persistence. It was a craft. It was hard work. You didn't just sit around waiting for inspiration. If you were at the keyboards, that's when the inspiration would come. Well, he was asked what his two favorite songs were. Here's what he said.
I'd probably put Take It Easy in because it was the first Eagles song and really sort of was America's and everybody's first image of our band, you know. And I think it was the vistas of the Southwest and, you know, it was the beginnings of what became country rock. Mm-hmm. I would put in Desperado, which is the first song Don Henley and I wrote together. And I think I was 24 and Don was 26. And to think that 20 years later, you know, this song would stand the test of time, would still be being recorded by people and performed by people, I would put that in there. One of these nights, my personal favorite Eagles song along with I Can't Tell You Why, I think I would put, those are two of my personal favorites.
Well, those were a few, and then, of course, so many others, which he would go on to list in this interview with Bob Costas some time ago, back in, I think, in the mid-1990s, wasn't it, Jesse? Something way back then? And one of them was Desperado, and so many people read so much into this song. Let's take a listen to that classic.
Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? You've been out riding fences for so long now. Oh, you're a hard one, but I know that you got your reasons. These things that are pleasing you can hurt you somehow. Don't you draw the queen of diamonds, boy. She'll beat you if she's able. You know the queen of hearts is always your best bet. Now it seems to me some fine things have been laid upon your table, but you only want the ones that you can't get.
Like he said, he loved the singing and sounds of other voices and other guitars. He had a solo career, but in the end, he was always most at home with his boys, with Don Henley, writing with him, letting Don sing his songs, him singing his, him singing ones that Don mostly wrote. Let's take a listen to another one as we go out on the break, one he loved, and that's Peaceful Easy Feeling.
I like the way your sparkling earrings lay against your skin so brown. And I want to sleep with you in the
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. The life of Glenn Frey. More after this on Our American Stories. Found out a long time
another tequila sunrise, staring slowly across the sky. Said goodbye. He was just a hired hand, working on the dreams he planned to try. Days go by.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we're talking about Glenn Frey's life, his music. We're hearing from Glenn himself about his own life, about writing, about the band. And they had hit after hit, but they really hit their stride when Joe Walsh got added to the band. They hit their creative peak with a little record called Hotel California, which ended up selling 16 million records that year and 40 million worldwide. And here's Glenn Frey talking about that record and why, in his opinion, it was the Eagles' best.
That was probably our best record as far as making a record is concerned. I think Hotel California, the album, and Hotel California, the song, were probably the zenith of the Eagles in that what we had to say came together with our learning of how to make records. And that song was co-written with Don Henley and also with Don Felder, an often not recognized but integral part of the Eagles in the second half of the band.
Yeah, we learned in an earlier, we did about a half hour on just the song about 3 months ago. You can catch it on OurAmericanNetwork.org. And it turned out that Don sent loops to the guys Don Felder sent loops to Don Henley and Glenn Frey, and they loved this loop, which would turn into the song Hotel California. Let's take a listen to some of the really remarkable lyrics, though, in this, well, American classic. You almost hate stopping it because it's telling such a story. And by the way, ask any five people what that story is about, and you'll hear five different answers. And probably ask those same people a year later, and you'll hear five new answers, depending on where they are in their life and what they're going through at that time in their life. Like so many really great pieces of art, which this was. And here's Glenn Frey talking about why this song was so great.
Don and I talked about that song, and you know, we were big big Steely Dan fans. Mm-hmm. And we were always quite amazed that Steely Dan was so brave lyrically. They got the Steely Dan T-shirts. You know, they had lines in their songs that we would sort of looked at ourselves and says, whoa, would we have put that in one of our songs? We started talking about Hotel California and wanted to sort of write a song that was sort of like an episode of The Twilight Zone. All of our songs were cinematic, but we wanted to open up it was just one shot to the next, and they didn't necessarily make sense. It was just picture of the guy on the highway, picture of the hotel, picture, you know, and the guy walks in, the door opens, strange people, and it's just sort of following this guy, and it doesn't really make sense.
It doesn't really make sense, but yet in the end it does. Later on in that interview with Bob Costas, he talked about how the song had a sort of perfect ambiguity, which was the goal they were after, and a mood and a series of images they were going after as well. You know, Bob Seger was asked, and he was a friend of Glenn's, what broke up the Eagles, and he said there are two words: Hotel California. The odd thing about the really remarkable status these guys achieved is that the critics really didn't like them. In fact, I'm going to read you the opening of this CNN piece on Glenn's passing, and here's what they said. This is the lead. It was hard to turn on the radio in the 1970s without hearing a song by Glenn Frey, the founding member of the Eagles, who died Monday at age 67. He co-wrote or sang almost all of the band's biggest hits, such as Tequila Sunrise, New Kid in Town, and Heartache Tonight. Whatever you may think of the country-tinged California rock band, and some critics hated them, boom, there it is. I mean, he just dies, and they're throwing in that lots of people hated him. Does that happen to any other gigantic band? Just very strange. They were never respected. I believe a lot of it had to do because they were, A, so good-looking, they so together, they sounded so beautiful. Everybody else was going through early grunge, acid. It was the Woodstock, Haight-Ashbury, rebellious sound. Even Led Zeppelin, you'd go to the stage, he was unkempt, the band was unkempt. These guys were scrubbed, and they were from Southern California. Oh, my goodness, nothing serious could come from Southern California. But the music was great, the musicianship was great. And, okay, say it's not your thing, but the way these guys got dumped on, it just wasn't deserved. Let's hear Glenn Frey talking about his critics.
Now, I really believe, you know, firmly that if you're getting bad reviews, you're doing something right.
But don't they hurt?
Well, we used to have a list, you know, which was sort of punch 'em on sight. There was a punch 'em on sight list, you know, and we were protective not only of our own music, but I think what really hurt was when we'd see people rail Jackson Browne or J.D. South or Souther Hillman and Furey,
yeah.
Or, you know, people that we knew, you know, not just ourselves, but... I think you have to, you know, you have to understand, you know, that these people sit at typewriters and, you know, in little funky corners of the world and sort of wish they were doing what we were doing. We didn't get a lot of good reviews. Got a lot of good reviews live. You know, our show was, you know, we used to get good reviews toward the end. But, you know, we were never the darlings of the critics. And that suits me just fine.
That was just a beautiful description of these guys pounding away at their typewriters, wishing they could be musicians. I feel the same way about a lot of sports writers. If you can't do it, well, then let me gain power over those that can by criticizing them and letting them know whether I deem their record worthy or not. What a thing to do for a living, actually. You couldn't pay me all the money in the world to be a rock critic or a theater critic. I know how hard doing these things are. And love on stuff that's good. And if it's not your style, so what? So much of our identities are tied up in a certain type of music. I had so many friends who, because they love metal, they couldn't listen to country or even rock. And the Stones people didn't listen to the Beatles people. And I said, can't you listen to both? Aren't they just good? Can't you at least appreciate both? One of my favorites and the first song that I fell in love with the Eagles was Lion Eyes. Let's take a listen. I just love the way that song starts. Who starts a song off like that? City girls just seem to find out early how to open doors with just a smile. I'm in. You got me. You hooked me. That's the thing. I love the Stones because they're great guitar hooks. But I love the Eagles because they're great lyrical hooks. They're different. But they're the same. And that's what music's about. Hooking us. Taking us to another place. And we want to close things out with that song Hotel California again, because remember what Glenn Frey said at the beginning. He loved the sound and clank of the guitars. He loved the voices. And you could always watch him in concert. And when it finally got to those dueling guitars at the end, he would just sit there and let the two lead guitarists duel it out. And he was just so happy watching his boys play. He wasn't taking the leads, but he was watching them. So let's take a listen to this classic song, this great ending, and what a great life, well-lived, Glenn Frey. And here's Hotel California's guitar solo. This is Lee Habib, the life of Glenn Frey, and this is Our American Stories. Great job as always on this, Jesse, and the whole team.
Just love singing with other people, finding harmony parts and blending, coming in at the same time, scooping, cutting off right. You know, it's, it is a lot of fun.